Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron explore the impact of friends, family, and communities on happiness and well-being. This is a universal component of humanity that provides sources of happiness regardless of economics. But it isn't enough to wait for opportunities to come up. You need to put in the effort to make it happen. They discuss how even though technology and social media can make some things easier, the cons may outweigh the pros, and it is vitally important to see people face to face. If you can imagine how people made friends and developed connections before the internet, you can start to understand the steps you should take to develop friendships that lead to a happier life. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Trishul Patel. I'm a wealth manager on the East Coast coming out of Pennsylvania. And I'm here with Aaron Ogti. He's a financial advisor in the Bay Area.
Hi, Trishul. How are you doing today?
Doing well, Aaron. Thanks for chatting with me today. And thanks everybody for listening. On this episode, we're going to be digging into a topic on well-being, continuing from what we discussed last week on financial well-being. This time, we're going to look into the impact of family, friends, and communities on long-term well-being and kind of what does this mean for an individual and how should an individual think about these different concerns as it relates to themselves. So to kick things off, Aaron, what does the impact of family, friends, and communities mean to you in terms of long-term well-being?
So I think back to our kind of original, one of the studies we talked about where you need about $75,000 in the US to be happy. And it's kind of, there was a direct correlation between income and happiness up to that level. But when I think about focusing on the friends, family, and communities, I mean, what if you go really down on that spectrum? So we're imagining a poor third world country, and they just don't have the same level of income. They don't have the same level of lifestyle that developed countries do, but they're still capable of being happy. So imagine someone living in this poor third world country who is genuinely happy. They're smiling, probably even laughing at that time. What are they doing? And you can actually envision they're not sitting alone by themselves. They're in a room with people that they love and care about, and they're telling jokes. They are reminiscing, retelling stories that they've known. They have this really strong, just personal bond, an interpersonal bond and connection with other people. And it is very easy to imagine that you don't need money to be happy, that you can have a fulfilling life without the income if you have those friends, families, and communities, if you have those relationships. And I think this is just part of the human condition. I think it's just the way that humans evolved over the literal history of humanity, that we are developed as social creatures. And nothing here is going to be shocking. Nothing is going to be surprising. Everything here is going to kind of make common sense, that those who spend time with friends and family are happier than those who spend time alone. That there's, we all have kind of other little stories here, but it's just that general idea that it's not groundbreaking. It's not shocking. It makes sense to you. But the difference of what I do want to get into is those who just kind of let that happen normally in their life and they see family around the holidays versus those who are consciously aware of how that impacts their life and then designing their lifestyle around spending time with friends, family, and community. So I'm curious to you, I was like, What does it mean to you, basically? Like when I describe that feeling of hanging out with friends and family and smiling and laughing, do you also see the same thing And are you aware of it? Do you see that in the moment, and do you seek that out specifically?
I think I do, Aaron. From my perspective, I've noticed in my life, the close relationships and the time with family are certainly something that is special to how I've grown up and how I've been raised and how I want to live my life as an adult. I think it is partly common sense, but also I think there's a good amount of research out there that backs this up, this notion that we are social creatures and it's an important part of who we are as humans. For example, there was a good amount of research done on this topic of the impact of having a social network around you. In fact, this was studied by a population of individuals in California. It's called the Social Network Host Resistance and Morality Study, started in the 60s. And they looked at about 7,000 people in California, and they looked at their social network and compared the people who had a lot of social interactions and contacts. And they looked at them, you know, like 9 years on and said, all right, what happened to these people? And interestingly enough, or I guess maybe obviously enough, the people that had a stronger social network, in fact, lived longer. It actually made a profound impact on how long these individuals lived. If you look at the differential between those that were most isolated and those that had the most amount of social contacts, it adds about 2 to 3 years on the life expectancy of an individual. That's a pretty big change for a change that, as you said, is kind of free. So I think the impact of this can be pretty great if you think about it that way.
That is pretty impactful. And just being the mathematician that I am as a background, thinking like 2 or 3 years on a large scale is actually pretty huge to move an entire group or class of people of with a large enough sample size, 2 or 3 years. That's pretty profound. Like you get the difference between smoking and non-smoking. That sounds like the scale of that difference. And even then, that might even be bigger than the difference between smoking and non-smoking.
I'm not quite sure about that, but like there was a study out of Brigham Young University, and they looked at the important factors for longevity. And the top three, you might even guess what these are. The first was drinking and smoking. that made the top three. The second was your close relationships. Basically, the people you interact with on a daily basis and the support you have in terms of what happens during bad times. But also the third is just your social integration with society. So these are the people you meet on your way to work, or you meet at a coffee shop like your barista. These are people you interact kind of not closely, but just enough to have a small conversation here and there. So these three factors seem to be quite important into how long you will actually live, interestingly enough.
That does remind me of other research. I believe it was the Harvard Business Review, and I will try and double check that. That it was looking at kind of different factors that go into satisfaction with work. And obviously kind of relationship with your boss was one of them, and probably the biggest one. Just that if you have a supportive manager that helps you further your career, you are satisfied and you actually, it's possible to enjoy that work. And we'll go kind of deeper into well-being related to work later. But the other one was having a work spouse. And once my wife pointed this out to me, I realized I had a work spouse, and then he moved to out of state, changed jobs, and I never developed that work spouse again. And my satisfaction at work went down. And she's described every stop along the way. She's found a work spouse, and apparently this is a fairly common thing that people don't necessarily realize the phrase, but as soon as you mention that, it's right. The person you go get lunch with, the person you hang out with in the hallways, that you look forward to seeing that person. And it's that interpersonal relationship that has nothing to do with the work that you're doing or the company you're at that impacts how well you enjoy going to work. That, and it's just, it's another thing that supports that if you are kind of aware of it, once you see it, you seek those things out, that you decide, oh, I like my work spouse, so I'm going to stay at this company, even though the work might be a little harder or I might be able to get a raise somewhere else. But if that work spouse happens to leave, you're already on LinkedIn and Indeed looking for a new job. It had nothing else changed from your manager or the work you're doing or your salary, but you lost that interpersonal connection that you had just in the hallways, and your satisfaction with your career went down just a little bit. Your satisfaction with your job went down just a little bit.
I can see that. It's like a divorce or a breakup.
It is, yeah, yeah. It's similar feelings. And so those who have found the person they enjoy hanging out with at work enjoy their work more. They like going to the office more. So once she pointed this out, and I kind of started paying attention to this more, I started looking for other opportunities to kind of recreate that in my own life. And especially now that I've started my own company, I work from home most of the time. I don't have a work spouse. I look around and there's no, my dog is on the couch, but there's no one else here. But what I have done is, for context, I'm in the Bay Area. Traffic is really, really bad. So San Francisco is about 20 miles away. And if I was trying to get into San Francisco in the evening, might take me about an hour to an hour and 20 minutes, depending on where in the city I'm going. But traffic in the middle of the day is actually pretty light. So I have specifically been reaching out to friends that I have who live in the Bay Area. They might only be 20 miles away, but they work in the city, and I go and have lunch with them. I've been seeking out the opportunities to make sure that I'm not staying alone and taking advantage of the fact that I can now go into the city to see them in the middle of the day, and planning these lunches and scheduling more of these throughout my career that I wasn't able to do when I was in the office. So, and that's my own personal story, but my emphasis is look for those opportunities to spend more time with friends and family. And so I'm curious for you, what are some of the things that you have specifically done in your life focusing on trying to spend more time with friends and family?
I think those are good questions, Aaron. And the way I see it from my perspective, like what you have done, is I've tried to engineer my life to revolve around the things that matter to me the most. And that means giving ample time for friends and family. And that does come with the flexibility from working from home, from starting a business and being my own boss. So I think that entrepreneurial spirit that came with launching a firm also gives the flexibility to be able to hit the road on the weekend to see friends and family, or take a day off now and then, or work remotely to incorporate these things into my life. So I think that's kind of been important. And I think what that highlights, Aaron, is the notion that we do have the choice to give these things priority in our lives, especially knowing the impact that they could potentially have on how we feel. And as we've just discussed, how long we'll live. Something that also I want to touch upon is it seems like what's really important with these social interactions is that they're done face-to-face. Mm-hmm. And the reason I kind of bring this up is there is an alternative for social interactions these days, and that's social media. But there's been a good amount of research that's coming out now that's saying that those types of social interactions aren't the same as in person. Something that kind of hit the headlines not too long ago was the notion that, or the question that was researched was, does social media cause depression?
I saw that.
Right. And this ended up being our causal study. It wasn't just a correlation that they found, but they really noticed that individuals who use more social media ended up being more depressed. What you might notice is when you're on social media, you're of course seeing everybody's good sides. They're always posting the things that they love about their lives, and you get the impression that everybody's always happy and doing great things. And FOMO, or the fear of missing out, seems to drive a feeling of, hey, wait, why aren't I having this much fun? Everybody's life is perfect, but I'm still struggling as a human. So I think there could be some concern there that individuals should take into account when it comes to thinking about what an individual can do within their lives to kind of engineer more happiness with social connections. So I think that that might be something to think about.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, is that when you see them face to face and you can kind of have the conversation, you end up getting that just more intimate questions of the bad things along with the good. Because when you are able to have those conversations, you feel more comfortable opening up to that one person. And you know what? I'm having this issue that I'm dealing with, because that person can console you or help you, and you're okay opening up, and it works both ways, where the other person might open up to you. And so you don't feel that they are the ideal, always ideal situation that you see on social media, that you get the full picture. And that's what is part of what genuinely improves your well-being, is being able to have that kind of intimate interpersonal connection with a friend or a family member that you just don't get on social media, that you're only getting the idealized versions. And so you don't get to see the flaws, but you always see the flaws in your own life. It's hard to keep that context. I actually have a really good email chain with a lot of friends from college, and we've exchanged a few years ago. We actually kind of counted, because Gmail counted for us. We were over 10,000 emails combined, but that was at least 4 or 5 years ago. It would not surprise me if we've exchanged on the scale of 30 to 50,000 emails in the last 14 plus years. But this is been a huge part of our my life and all of our lives. These are the people I kind of stay in touch with most effectively. But it's the opportunities to see them in person that we specifically sought out. We actually try to plan kind of mini reunions where, because we're all spread out, we'll try to be in the same place at the same time. And some of them travel a little bit more, some with kids travel a little bit less, but we look for these opportunities to meet up in person. And again, it's nothing new. Even the word, the meetup idea is kind of been around as long as social media. It's like, even people who only know each other through the internet or through social media, there's still that desire to meet up. And there's a difference between a relationship that you only have over the internet, and once you have actually met in person, that relationship is stronger. And it's it's hard to, unless you're looking for that, unless you're trying to achieve that, you may never actually, you never go down that path. You have to choose to schedule the time, because there's a lot of logistics involved. It doesn't always work out, and it's a pain, and it's annoying to try and coordinate schedules. And those are the things that are not easy and not hard. But it's like, that's part of what I'm trying to say, is that it is worth the inconvenience of meeting in person. Your life is better when you are adding complexity and stress to, instead of just do the easy thing and talk to them online, make the effort to meet them in person.
That makes sense to me. So from one standpoint, the notion could be that the technology and social tools that we have for online presence can help form the connections, but to really make the bonds, what might be better is to use those connections to actually drive interpersonal face-to-face connections.
Yeah, it's ideally, yeah, you can use technology to make it easier to find time to see that person, kind of thing. But I think from that perspective, technology can't help that much, because you can do a scheduling software and try and find that time, but it's still going to be significantly more burdensome to try and meet that person in real life than online.
In terms of how society is kind of set up, one thing we might notice here in the United States is we seem to be quite independent in how we navigate our lives and careers. And the reason I say that is, you know, maybe in the past, an individual graduated from school and stayed in the same town and grew up with the same people in the same community and had the same job until they retired and they got their pension and so on within that same city. But I feel like things are a little different now, where it's not unheard of for an individual to go to school in a completely different state and then go work in a completely different state from that and then hop around every few years in terms of their careers. Do you think as a society, this has made it more challenging to develop these types of social connections and to keep them alive? Or do you think that's been compensated by the extra technology we have to help keep these connections going? For example, as you mentioned, you know, with your email chats with your college buddies, it certainly makes it a lot easier than everybody sending telegrams to each other using Morse code or whatever was common a couple years ago.
The short answer is yes. I think you're completely right. The longer answer is, I wonder how much of that is US specific and how much of that is just the last 20 years. So the US, probably just because of how big it is, does have that effect of people grow up in one area, they go to college in another, and they find a career in a third place. And I think that has been around longer than the internet. But I think that before the internet, you might have kept a few connections from where you grew up or college, but you're still more likely to find those new connections at your new place. Whereas now, you're more likely to keep those original connections, and you can actually keep them fairly well, but you might be less likely to seek out the new connections where you're physically located. And so I guess my the closest thing I have to an observation is, do you know who your next door neighbor is?
Not by name.
And that's kind of my point. I happen to know one next door neighbor. Okay. We've had enough conversations. The other one, I know their name, but haven't really had deep conversations. I don't know two doors down either way.
Right.
And
right.
Unfortunately,
and how long have you lived there?
I've been here for 3+ years.
Okay.
Although the ones I don't know as well, they've only been there for a year.
I see what you're getting at.
But it's kind of, I think before the internet, people would have reached out to their local community almost by default, just a little bit more.
Hmm.
And now with the internet, I'm going to schedule time with my good friend from college who lives 10 miles away. And we're going to meet up somewhere. Whereas as before, it's like I might have seen them around, but I have to actually call them and hope that they're home to then try and schedule something with them farther in advance. Like, this right. is why invitations were an actual thing. You threw a party, you had to create an invitation, send it out months in advance so that they could arrange their schedule around to be at this specific location at the specific time.
It's interesting because when I think of a village back in the day, I imagine there's like a community square where people just gather
yeah.
and hang out.
Yep.
Does your city have this type of square?
I mean, it does a little bit, but my city, even within the Bay Area, my city's still like 50 or 70,000 people.
Right.
So it's already big. And this is a relatively small city in the Bay Area. The closer thing I have experienced is actually my kids' school. And I do see this among other parents quite a bit, where I actually see other parents on a regular basis during drop-offs and pickups and going to things like PTA meetings.
Okay.
Like there, I actually learn about people that I just would never have met otherwise. And a few of them I've had multiple conversations over time. It's PTA meetings and kids sports. So I coach my daughter's soccer teams this fall. So I see some of the same girls on different teams from season to season. And same thing with softball in the spring. So those are some of the, I guess I say, old-fashioned connections, right. where 30, 40 years ago, these would have been the only people I'm seeing. So I'm going to develop a deeper connection. And it's like, hey, what are you doing after this? Do you want to hang out this weekend? Because I'm going to see them at practice on Tuesday and we'll plan something after the game on Saturday. But now I actually have plans to go see other friends and they have plans to go see their friends. And so we don't even bother trying. And so I think there's the combination of the geographical size and relocations within the US, but also the internet and technology has made us less likely to foster those interpersonal relationships that would have developed in the past. And I'm really curious. So I think you've lived in other countries, I believe. Now, so I'm really curious for other countries that just aren't as large as the US or don't have as much kind of relocation, do you see that people develop stronger friendships with their community a little more effectively? So like you mentioned that little village, have you observed that?
I think so. I think from my time in Southeast Asia or even my travels around India in Africa, what I kind of see in some of these villages is this community feel where there's always these little groups of individuals who meet up every day around the same time. And they're, you know, either playing cards or chess or dominoes or just chatting, you know, in the village gazebo or something like that. And I feel like the bonds that they share are something that might be a bit missing from what I've experienced here in the States. This also reminds me of a culture that I once read about in Japan, in Okinawa. So Okinawa, Japan is an area where they have one of the longest life expectancies in the world. Japan in general boasts, I think it's around 90 years life expectancy for a female versus 81 for the US, and about 84 for males versus high 70s for a male in the US. So these are pretty big differences, and maybe part of what explains these differences is the social bonds that the society creates for people in Okinawa. They actually have a name for it. It's called the Moai. And what it is it's a group of lifelong friends where the parents basically say, you five kids, you're about the same age, you're going to be friends for the rest of your life until you're 100 years old. And it's amazing what drives or comes off of this. You have a group of people who are your peers. Now, this can happen with siblings, but siblings aren't always the same age. And, you know, maybe you don't have enough, or maybe they're a different gender. But these are five friends who have been grouped together at a young age, create a strong bond with each other, and they keep it throughout their entire lives, where they are able to share pains and sufferings and provide each other with financial support and social support. And it's something where they end up developing such a deep bond and a sense of mutual respect for each other that individuals have a sense of a safety net that money can't buy. So I think from what I've observed in my travels and from what I've observed learning about cultures like this one in Okinawa, I feel like there's room for growth in what could happen in a society like this one in the United States.
I like that story. It reminds me of a comment. This is not research based, but it's just one of those things that felt true, that childhood friendships might be easier to maintain because as you were going through your developmental stage, you were working on the same interests and likes with your friends. And so you built the same interests, whereas an adult, it's harder to find an adult friend who already has the same interests. This kind of fits with the story from the groups in Okinawa. It kind of doesn't matter who you pick as long as you start it young enough where they're going to grow together. That makes a lot more sense than trying to put five already established adults together and say, okay, now now you're going to be friends.
Right. That makes sense. So I think from these perspectives, what we're finding is that for an individual, we have the opportunity to make strategic decisions that might increase our well-being from a social standpoint in terms of how we interact with the people that are close to us, with our friends and our families and communities. And there might also be things to learn from other cultures and societies around the world that might be beneficial to increasing well-being across these different social interactions.
So as we kind of wrap up, it did remind me of a presentation. I was invited to give a presentation on stock options and restricted stock units at a company in San Francisco that was going IPO. And so a lot of the employees, they had some options or RSUs. So they're having a small windfall. It's not necessarily life-changing. I'm sure for some of the founders it was, but for most people, this is on the scale of 3 months to a year's worth of salary. So it's like, oh, this is a decent chunk of money, but it's not enough to be financially independent or retire. And so a lot of the presentation was just on the technical tax and investment advice. Like, here's how stock options work. Here's how RSUs work. But at the end, I kind of told them, okay, we're done with the certified financial planner advice, that of the, here's the technical information that you need to help you make decisions. And my last slide was kind of talking about this, was the happiness research and some of the kind of just very, very rough observations I've made over the years, and trying to like give a large room, like advice collectively just doesn't work. So it's kind of, I'm trying to keep it super, super general, but I said, don't buy the car. And it's kind of fits with what I think this might have been your first podcast, our first podcast. So your comment was the exact same thing. Don't buy the new car. And my theme there was just material purchases don't impact happiness. They don't impact well-being. They become part of your baseline 6 to 12 months later. It just doesn't have the impact. I suggested, if you were looking to splurge, spend the money on a vacation. And the idea here is that you're building memories and experiences that shown that that has had a positive impact on happiness. But better yet, go visit friends and family. Spend the money on a vacation to see friends and family, because now you're combining that experience with the benefits of social interaction and developing those deeper relationships. And it doesn't have to be that much on a vacation, but if you have this kind of extra money, consciously choosing to spend time with friends and family, I think is the most impactful way that you can use your money to live a better life. And so is half jokingly, half kind of just giving them context. But I think that that really does hold true, that when you have the capacity, choose to spend time with friends and families and communities whenever you can. And going to visit a friend or family member that's in a different state that you haven't seen, because the United States is a large country and we're all spread out. So it's hard. It's not easy to make that happen. So you have to plan it. You have to kind of figure out how much I'm going to spend, how much can I afford, how much time is this going to cost me, but it's worth it. Those are things that you really should be focusing on and pursuing to live the life that you want to enjoy, to live a better life and to be happy and to have that well-being.
I like that. I think that makes a very important point. Something that may even get overlooked when somebody thinks about a financial planner or financial planning. The notion is that we're not really only talking about how to pay off your credit cards or get your bank statements correctly accounted for or save enough for your 401k and things like that. But what we're really talking about here is, how does one plan their life so that they'll be happy? How does one plan their life so that they'll not only have financial freedom, but just freedom in general to pursue what's important? So I think you make some very good points on why we're trying to do what we do and why we approach this notion of planning the way we do, where it's not just a focus on the numbers and the finances, but also the big picture of what it means to come up with a plan that provides freedom for an individual. So I think that's a pretty good place to end upon. And thanks, Aaron. I appreciate your time. Do you want to add anything else?
No, I think that we had a great conversation today. I love the relationship that you and I are developing via these conversations.
We should probably meet in person one day.
We are going to consciously plan out how and when, and it's going to be extremely inconvenient for both of us, but it will be worth it.
That sounds like a plan.
Okay. Thanks, Trishul.
Well, thank you, Aaron. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And of course, if you like what you have heard today, do spread the word. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye. We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.